Hey everyone, it's Fina 007 here for the latest episode of Vassals of Kingsgrave's Agatha Christie Linear Reread. And in this episode 47, we're going to be talking about Hickory Dickory Dock, also known as Hickory Dickory Death. And it was originally published in October 1955. Now this, as many of the novels in the 1950s, is going to be another mini pod, which means I'm discussing it on my own. It doesn't get a full episode because it's not particularly good. And you'll have heard me and Pat use phraseology like top tier Christie and second tier Christie. And I truly believe this is third tier Christie. It's a painful book to read. I normally read these in one sitting. I normally time them for when I have some travel so I can read them on a flight. But I picked this one up and put it down so many times I found it like wading through molasses. It was not pleasurable to read, maybe because a lot of the characters are just unpleasant, but not in an overarching evil tone that's interesting in its own right. It's just a nasty, squalid little novel that runs for around 250 pages, so it's not one of her longest, but it feels very long and tortuous. So let's get into it. As always, this will be spoiler-free up until the end credits music, and then we'll get into the solution and the clues. So the big concept of this novel is that it is set in a student hostel. Poirot is initially asked to investigate a series of petty thefts and pieces of sabotage that have happened in the hostel. And the reason he goes there, because this does very much seem beneath him at first, is that the hostel is run by his secretary, Miss Lemon's sister, Mrs. Hubbard. So this is the first time in a full-length novel that we're getting Miss Lemon, a character who will be very well known to all of us who've watched the David Suchet TV adaptations. But we finally meet Miss Lemon here, and she's going to look very different to the Miss Lemon of the TV show. Here is the list of what has been stolen. Evening shoe, one of a new pair, bracelet, costume jewellery, diamond ring found in a plate of soup, powder compact, lipstick, stethoscope, earrings, cigarette lighter, old flannel trousers, electric light bulbs, box of chocolates, silk scarf found cut to pieces, rucksack, ditto, boracic powder, bath salts, a cookery book. So it's a completely ramshackle list. It's always interesting, right, when Agatha Christie gives you a list or a map or a letter that's actually shown as a letter rather than text. Pay attention to the list. So that's why I read it out just then. And the plot of the novel is that Poirot quite easily identifies the thief, but then the thief is very quickly murdered. Now, also, this is one of a series of novels that have nursery rhyme titles. So this is taken from Hickory Dickory Dock. Mouse ran up the clock. The clock struck one, the mouse ran down Hickory Dickory Dock. I mean, it's not a very well worked in nursery rhyme title because literally the only thing connecting this novel to the nursery rhyme is the fact the hostel is set on Hickory Road. And I suppose by giving Miss Lemon's sister the married name of Mrs. Hubbard, it's also alluding to another nursery rhyme. But really, this is very, very thin gruel, I would say. As I said before, this book was published in October of 1955. The previous book had been published in November of 1954, so Destination Unknown. Agatha Christie's readers have therefore had a year's worth of historical events against which to set the events of this book in context. So let's bring ourselves up to speed. December 1954, the US Senate votes 67-22 to condemn Joseph McCarthy for conduct that brings the Senate into dishonor and disrepute. We also get the opening of the first Burger King in Miami, Florida. In January of 1955, US Congress authorizes President Eisenhower to use force to protect Taiwan from the People's Republic of China, something that is geopolitically relevant even today. In March 1955, and this is something of the ongoing civil rights movement, Claudette Colvin, a 15-year-old African-American girl, refuses to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, to a white woman after the driver demands it. She is carried off the bus backwards while being kicked, handcuffed, and harassed on her way to the police station. She becomes a plaintiff in Browder v. Gale, 1956, which rules that bus segregation is unconstitutional. Also in March 1955, Elvis Presley makes his TV debut on Louisiana Hayride. We also get the movie adaptation of the novel Blackboard Jungle, which features the famous single Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his comments. So we have really the rise of the teenager in this period. In April 1955, Winston Churchill resigns as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom due to ill health. He is 80, which I guess puts the current US presidential election in context. We also have the Salk polio vaccine getting full approval by the FDA. And the first franchised McDonald's restaurant is opened by Ray Kroc in Des Plaines, Illinois. May 1955, West Germany becomes a sovereign country. A young Jim Henson introduces the earliest version of Kermit the Frog. And 8 communist bloc countries, including the Soviet Union, sign a mutual defense treaty known as the Warsaw Pact. In July 1955, Ruth Ellis is hanged for murder in London. She is the last woman ever to be executed in the United Kingdom. And in a lighter note, the Disneyland theme park opens in Anaheim, California. In August 1955, and this is really sobering, black 14-year-old Emmett Till is lynched and shot in the head for allegedly whistling at a white woman in Money, Mississippi. His white murderers are acquitted by an all-white jury. September 1955, Little Richard records Tutti Frutti in New Orleans, and it's released in October. Seminal moment in rock and roll history, but also queer history, if you listen to the original lyrics, and if you think of Little Richard and his whole life. Also in September 1955, Vladimir Nabokov publishes controversial novel Lolita. We get commercial television in the United Kingdom with the formation of the Independent Television Authority's ITV, which is going to be the channel that all those decades later produces those David Suchet TV shows. September 1955, James Dean dies in a car crash. A month later, his only film, Rebel Without a Cause, is released in the United States. So truly, it's the era of the teenager. Okay, so those are the events of the time. Cold War suspicion and paranoia, technological advances, and the civil rights movement gathering steam. And against that, we have our published novel, Hickory Dickory Dock. So let's start with the characters. We, of course, have Hercule Poirot, but we also have Miss Lemon. This is how she is described, and this is actually how the book opens. Hercule Poirot frowned. "Miss Lemon," he said. "Yes, Monsieur Poirot. There are 3 mistakes in this letter." His voice held incredulity. For Miss Lemon, that hideous and deficient woman, never made mistakes. She is never ill, never tired, never upset, never inaccurate. For all practical purposes, that is to say, she was not a woman at all. She was a machine, the perfect secretary. She knew everything, she coped with everything. She ran Hercule Poirot's life for him, so that too functioned like a machine. Order and method had been Hercule Poirot's watchwords for many years ago. With George his perfect manservant and Miss Lemon his perfect secretary, order and method ruled supreme in his life. So that's the description of Miss Lemon, which is very different in looks with her grizzled hair than the lovely, glamorous Miss Lemon we know from the TV show. But let us make mention here of the fact that this book is going to be unusually populated with a diverse set of characters. And therefore, it is a book which is going to be unusually populated with racism. And rather than have a progressive or regressive section kind of towards the end of this podcast, which is what I normally do, I'm just going to tackle it as we go through character by character because it's so commonplace. So even Miss Lemon is a racist. This is her describing her sister, Mrs. Hubbard, and the hostel that she runs. She's always been fond of young people and good with them, and having lived in the East so long, she understands racial differences and people's susceptibilities. Because these students at the hospital are of all nationalities, mostly English, but some of them actually black, I believe. "Half the nurses in our hospital seem to be black nowadays," said Miss Lemon doubtfully. "And I understand much pleasanter and more attentive than the English ones." End quote. Now, I'm not saying that this represents Agatha Christie's own attitudes towards black people and black nurses and the rising tide or the rising visibility of people in the UK at this point. But it is interesting that, oh, what would this have been? 7 years after HMS Windrush, 7 years after we saw a call go out to the West Indies, to the colonies, to come for jobs to England post-war because we really needed labour. you saw an influx of people coming for work, skilled people and unskilled people, doing much needed work, and you're starting to see in the popular literature of the day people being confronted by this and maybe feeling a little bit uneasy with it. So it is fascinating to me to see such a one as Miss Lemon expressing, I mean, the way Agatha Christie writes, some of them are even black. Black is in italics. It's really disconcerting. So let's now move to Hickory Road. And the way this is set up is that Mrs. Nicoletis, who owns the house, it's actually two houses that are joined together on the ground floor to make a big common dining room and common area. And then the boys sleep in the bedrooms on one side of the house, in one of the houses, and the girls in the other house, so that propriety is kept with that situation. And Mrs. Hubbard works as the warden. So this is how Mrs. Nicoletis is described. She is part Greek. We're going to discover that she's a secret alcoholic and that she also prefers rich American tenants to colored people, capital C, capital P. This is a quotation. And if it is these colored students, these Indians, these Negresses, they can all go, you understand. The color bar, it means everything to these Americans. And for me, it is the Americans that matter. As for the colored ones, scram. End quote. So she wants to take the rich American tenants and feels that the Americans are racist against black people. So why should she have black tenants? It's almost like I'm not even sure she's racist herself. It's just she wants to pander to the Americans' segregation ways, I guess. Ridiculous. But then I was wondering when reading one of her hysterical outbursts whether Mrs. Nicoletis could have been subject to Nazi persecution in World War II. A little bit like the Hungarian housekeeper in A Murder is Announced. Because this is her reaction. Quote, Gestapo, said Mrs. Nicoletis, who was now quiet but sullen. I shouldn't think any more about it if I were you, said Mrs. Hubbard soothingly. Gestapo, said Mrs. Nicoletis again. Gestapo, that is what they are. They have to do their duty, you know, said Mrs. Hubbard. Is it their duty to pry into my private cupboards? End quote. So I don't know, maybe there's something more to her, but yes, she's treated as, you know, living amongst rather sort of disgusting soiled cushions and just low-level racism in the depiction of Mrs. Nicoletis. And she herself as a character is also racist. So there we are. Now let's have a look at the people who live at Hickory Road. The first is Celia Austin. She is a chemist in the dispensary at St. Catherine's Hospital. She is rather lovesick and really fancies Colin McNabb, who is a student who's doing postgraduate studies in psychology. And he's the one who had his trousers nicked. And it's interesting that Celia is the person who will go on to admit that she committed some of the petty thefts and will also be the murder victim, poisoned with morphine in her coffee. Amongst the girls, we also have Patricia Lane, who's a student with a diploma in archaeology. She's the one who owns the diamond ring that is stolen. She has a soft spot for Nigel Chapman. We also have Valerie Hobhouse, who is actually not a student, but is employed as the co-owner of Sabrina Fair, which is a beauty parlor. She's the one who has the diamond ring show up in her soup and her silk scarf cut up. We then have Sally Finch, who's an American student specializing in poetry. She's the one who has one of her expensive shoes stolen. And she's the one, maybe this is Agatha Christie trying to make a point about Americans being more sensitive to segregation and the color bar. But I don't know, it's weird because Sally Finch actually does have friendships with two black people who are living in the house. But the way in which she describes them is also racist. So there is a female student who's meant to be very smart. She's a law student called Elizabeth Johnston. She had her work ruined with green ink. And this is how Sally Finch describes her. What's happened to Black Bess? Agatha Christie editorializes. This nickname was an affectionate one and had been accepted as such by the girl herself. Had it really? Had it? I wonder how Black Bess really felt about that nickname. And then this is Sally Finch talking about Mr. Akibombo, who's an African student. Quote, Akibombo's scared, she said. He's always very superior and civilized, but there's a good old West African belief in magic very close to the surface. So neither of those two descriptions are particularly pleasing, especially as we see Agatha Christie kind of sign off on them or co-sign on them. So we've already mentioned Elizabeth Johnston, the highly impressive law student, but she herself has prejudices. Everyone's a little bit racist in the book. So this is what she says of Sally Finch, the American. Quote, That is her American way of thought. They are all the same, these Americans, nervous, apprehensive, suspecting every kind of foolish thing. Look at the fools they make of themselves with their witch hunts, their hysterical spy mania, their obsession over communism. Sally Finch is typical. I think that's, it's kind of interesting because actually, is that a rational thing to think at the time of the McCarthy witch hunts? Maybe. Okay, and so rounding out the female students, we have Genevieve Maricot, who's a French student studying English literature, and Jean Tomlinson, who is actually in full-time employment doing physical therapy at St. Catherine's Hospital. And she herself is also a little bit racist. Quotation. No, I don't think Nigel would do that either. I think it's much more likely to be Mr. Akibombo. Really? Why should he do it? Jealousy. All these coloured people are very jealous of each other and very hysterical. Wonderful. So that's the bunch of girls living in the house. Now let's get to the boys. There's Leonard, Len Bateson, a student residing at Hickory Road, studying medicine and surgery. He's Cockney. He's had his stethoscope nicked. It's known that he has a bit of a temper. There's Chandra Lal, an Indian student who's studying political science. He had his boracic powder, which you use to treat your eyes if your eyes are irritated. He has that stolen. We have Gopal Ram, another Indian student, also studying political science. Ahmed Ali, also an Egyptian student. The aforementioned Mr. Akibombo. René Halle, a French student, also studying English literature. And that rounds out the house. So it really is a diverse group. And I suppose in a way one should praise Agatha Christie for showing the true diversity of East London at this time and for focusing on student life. But my word, these portraits are all very disturbingly full of low-key racism. And that also goes for the staff, right? So also living in this house is Maria, the Italian cook, and Geronimo, her husband, who's basically the sort of the jack of all trades in the house. And they are shown to be basically completely hysterical Southern Europeans. I mean, it's just a very tropey, kind of cliched 1950s view of what Italians would be like, I guess, just very prejudiced. Quote, "It is I who will be accused, I and Geronimo, the povero. What justice can you expect in a foreign land? No, I cannot cook the risotto as you suggest. They send the wrong rice. I make you instead the spaghetti. We had spaghetti last night. It does not matter. In my country, we eat the spaghetti every day, every single day. The pasta, it is good all the time. Yes, but you're in England now. Very well, then, I make the stew, the English stew. You will not like it, but I make it. Pale, with the onions boiled in much water instead of cooked in the oil, and pale meat on cracked bones." Now, that's quite an interesting paragraph, right? Because maybe this is Agatha Christie, who has travelled the world at this point, commenting on why on earth would you have bad English food when you can have pasta. But still, the way in which it's drawn is just, yeah, it doesn't sit well. And later on in the novel, here's Geronimo, Maria's husband. Quote, "It is terrible," he whispered as he assisted Poirot off with his overcoat. "We have police here all the time. Ask questions. Go here, go there. Look in cupboards, look in drawers. Come into Maria's kitchen even." Maria, very angry. She says she liked to hit policemen with rolling pin, but I say better not. I say policemen not like being hit by rolling pins, and they make us more embarrassments if Maria do that. End quote. I mean, it's so infantilizing and so... I mean, I don't think it beats the depiction of the Hungarian cook in A Murder is Announced for sheer offensiveness, but this is very close on, right? Anyway, so this is the whole bunch of people that Hercule Poirot has to investigate. He has to figure out who was nicking the stuff, who was sabotaging the stuff at Hickory Road, why, and who murdered poor Celia. Let's get into adaptations. There's only one adaptation of this book, which is part of the David Suchet Poirot series on ITV. We also have Philip Jackson as Inspector Japp and Pauline Morin as Miss Lemon, very different to the book. Among the students, we have a lot of people who will go on to be more famous actors, including Damian Lewis from Band of Brothers and most recently Billions as Leonard Bateson. And Jonathan Firth, maybe most famously known as Colin Firth's little brother, as Nigel Chapman. A lot of the non-diverse. In this adaptation, a lot of the characters who aren't white are cut out. I'll get into why that does or doesn't work when we get into the solution and clues section. But there are other changes made. I think broadly speaking, it doesn't matter. It captures the spirit of the book. It's not a particularly good book, so I'm not that worried that they've sort of, you know, played a little fast and loose with the plotting. I don't think it's a particularly interesting adaptation unless you want to see a very, very young Damian Lewis. And frankly, I would give both book and adaptation a miss. This is one of my least favourite Agatha Christie novels. Which is a rather sad thing to say, isn't it? And it's not because I'm becoming jaded. I think you really are at this point, 1955, Agatha Christie's mid-60s. You're really seeing a drop-off in quality and indeed frequency. So there we are. Stay tuned after the end credits music for more on the solution, a little bit more on why this book is quite offensive. And if not, tune in next time for episode 48, in which we will cover Dead Man's Folly, another Hercule Poirot novel, but one that also includes Ariadne Oliver. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Okay, so let's get into the solution here. The first thing to say is that basically none of the characters of colour really matter in terms of being really serious suspects or being taken seriously, given proper fleshed out characters, being made to be part of the plot. Maybe Mr. Akibombo has more of a role, but there's a kind of low-level racism in populating a book with this many characters of colour and then only focusing all of the action on the white characters. And that's why in a television adaptation they can cut them all out, and it kind of solves the problem of racism while also being racist, right? It's just saying, well, let's just not bother making this better. So that didn't sit particularly well with me. But there's a lot going on in this book, so let's try and unpick what's happening. So first of all, where to begin? Let's start with Valerie. So Valerie's mum is actually Mrs. Nicoletis. And because Valerie works in this very high-end beauty salon, she's able to travel to and forth from France. She has multiple passports and different names and different passport photos with different hairstyles. And she is doing all this because she's running a low-level, small-scale smuggling business of drugs and precious jewels. Mrs. Nicoletis knows about it, and Mrs. Nicoletis's chain of student hostels provides useful fodder for Valerie. And that's why Mrs. Nicoletis has taken to drink and eventually has to be bumped off to keep her quiet. Valerie's partner in crime is Nigel Chapman. And the ruse that they come up with is that they have all the students in the house go to a preferred outfitter of rucksacks down the road. He sells a very good model, but it's much cheaper than the main shops. Of course, everyone buys from him. And they've created effectively false bottoms in the rucksack. And these students don't even know they're doing the smuggling. It's all about sort of swapping out rucksacks and getting the jewels and the heroin, which in pure form is very valuable at low weight. So I'm guessing the people carrying the rucksacks don't realize it. So that's the kind of the means of doing the smuggling. Now, what sets all the events of the novel in action, in motion, is that the police are investigating a totally different crime in a totally different town, but they're checking up on all the youth hostels in London. They knock on the door at Hickory Road, and suddenly Nigel and Valerie are in a panic, and Nigel rips up the rucksack that's in another student's room that's only just come back from abroad and throws it behind the boiler so that the police can't get to it. And actually, the police didn't know anything about the smuggling anyway, so it was complete nonsense. But unfortunately, one of the girls saw him do this while he was doing it. So the rucksack, that's why it's sabotaged. And it's also why the light bulbs were gone from the hallway, because he wanted to obscure the hallway. Now, the list that we were given at the start is, it's not that it's a red herring, because everything on the list is important, but we later have Poirot reorder the list in the order of when things happened. And you realise the rucksack and the light bulb were the first things to go, and therefore they're of the most importance. And so what happens next? We have to somehow hide the things that actually were sabotaged or went in amongst lots of other things. A bit like in other Agatha Christie books, you have a murder that's intentional hidden amongst other murders that aren't. So what happens is Valerie says to Celia, you know how you're really, really in love with Colin? And he's just obsessed with psychology. Why don't you start nicking small scale things like a powder compact and a lipstick And then confess, and then he'll be really interested in you because then you'll become a case. And it works, actually. It does work. The whole ruse works. The problem is Celia confesses to Poirot about the things she actually stole, but doesn't confess to the stuff that she didn't do, which again sort of forces Poirot's attention onto the rucksack, onto the light bulbs, onto the green ink that was tipped over Black Bess's work. So again, it serves to highlight. But Celia needs to be taken care of because she knows about Nigel and she's saying to Nigel, why don't you confess to ripping up the rucksack? Even though she doesn't know why and is quite innocent in her ways. So she has gotten rid of with morphine. Mrs. Nicoletis has got rid of again because she's unsafe. So she's gotten rid of. And finally, Patricia is gotten rid of because she has figured out a little of what's going on as well because she realized, oh, this is a whole nother side plot. This is why this book is so stupid. That the boys had had a bet that you couldn't find three poisons to murder someone. And Nigel Chapman had said, oh, I bet I can. I can find three different poisons within 24 hours, which he then does, partly by impersonating a young doctor to get some from the hospital dispensary, partly by stalking a country doctor and nicking something out of his medicine bag. So that should put you on alert with Nigel Chapman that he's a very, very dangerous person indeed. And you kind of feel for Valerie Hobhouse because she at some point becomes implicated in the murders, messing up the timeline around Pat by making a fake phone call. And she's basically a smuggler who's drawn into being an accessory to murder against her will, basically. Okay, and so all of that's gone on, and we still haven't got to the real kind of solution, which is that Nigel Chapman, when people tell you who they are, in the words of Maya Angelou, believe them. He has all the hallmarks of a classic Agatha Christie murderer. Remember, she believes, and the old man in Crooked House, the chief inspector tells us, that murderers are very boastful. They can't help boasting in front of an audience. They can't help telling you what they're up to, and they're show-offs, right? They want to draw attention to themselves. So everything we've seen of Nigel Chapman in the book tells us this. He's the one who pulled off this outlandish scheme to get three poisons. He kept them in his drawer. He had access to them. And if he can pull off, you know, nicking three types of poisons, why wouldn't he administer them? We also realize that just as Valerie Hobhouse has a alternative, I guess, you know, her mum's Mrs. Nicoletis, and we didn't know this, that Nigel Chapman also has a past whereby his father is actually Lord Stanley, who's a very famous research scientist. And he was basically, in fact, do we really know the reason? Because Nigel says that his dad killed his mum with an overdose of sleeping pills. We realize at the end that actually it was Nigel who killed his mum. Ah, yes, we do find out because Nigel's basically stolen money from his dad and forged checks. And his dad has said, you know, this is really going to be it. And his mum finds out that he's done something again. She's going to tell the dad. And basically Nigel kills her before, well, she does still do that after because she realizes she's been murdered or she's been poisoned. And so the dad does this really weird thing. He knows his son has murdered his wife, but rather than just calling in the police, he decides that his wife wouldn't have wanted the family name sullied. So he gets his son to write out a confession about the mum and says, if you ever commit another crime, I will hand this confession into the police. But I'm giving you another chance to live a life on the straight and narrow. You need to change your name. You're going to get your trust fund come through from your mum's side. And I really hope you make a fresh start of it, which I find to be so unbelievably naive. And the old man, Lord Stanley, has just died. But, and this is partly why Patricia has to be killed, because she kind of has a thing for Nigel and she's written to the dad to try and get them to reconcile. Ugh, anyway. So the dad has left instructions with his lawyer, known as Endicott, that, you know, after his death, he needs to check up on Nigel. And if Nigel's done anything, to give the cops the letter, the confession, which he does, he gives it to Poirot. And even here, like, this is how annoying this book is. It's just so unbelievably sloppy that the lawyer, Endicott, is meant to be the lawyer from the Abernathy case from after the funeral. But in this novel, they spell Abernathy wrong. So in After the Funeral, it's IE, and here it's with a Y. And also, the lawyer's not called Endicott. I think he's called Entwistle in After the Funeral. So, like, didn't a series editor pick that up? It just leads to that whole kind of impression of this being kind of slapdash and just kind of, I don't know, Yeah, it's not a good novel. There's just simultaneously so much plot and not enough plot and not a tight enough plot. I mean, yes, the mechanics sort of all work, but at the end of the day, oh, does anyone even care? It's just so poor. Anyway, I didn't like any of the characters here. I don't think they were memorable. They were all borderline racist. I think Agatha Christie's macro and micro choices are just really questionable, and it just left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. So I am going to say, do not read this book, do not watch the adaptation, and that's it, really. God, that's a very depressing end to the episode. If any of you out there have better and more positive things to say about this novel, please feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube channel, join us on the Discord, find me on Threads or Twitter at Bina007. I would love to discuss it with you and think this is better or come to the conclusion that this is better than I think it is, because I am just very, I don't know, maybe you can tell from this podcast, I feel very down on this book. And it feels weird to me. Like, there are other Agatha Christie books I haven't liked, but this one just really left me with a bad taste in the mouth.